You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a book frequently coveted and passed around by young girls turns 20 this month. We'll talk about how the care and keeping of you has made many girls feel more comfortable in their bodies as they grow up. First, school districts around the country are trying some new ways to address a growing problem: students missing class. According to the U.S. Department of Education, nearly 8 million students, or about 16%, were considered chronically absent for missing at least 15 days in the 2015-2016 school year. It's up from about 7 million 2 years earlier. A group called Attendance Matters released a survey this summer that showed Wisconsin's chronically absent rate to be about 16%. That's the 22nd highest in the country. In an effort to boost attendance, schools are trying a mix of punishments and rewards, from imposing re-enrollment fees to raffling off cars and other stuff. Tonnell Hobbs is the Wall Street Journal's national K-12 education reporter. Tonnell, welcome to Central Time.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
Well, this is something that's on the radar at school districts around the country and at the national level. Talk a little more about the growth, apparently, in chronic absenteeism.
Yes, it's just really, the last data, you just cited the 2015-16 data, but that's up 12% from 2013-14 school year. And, you know, this is the first school year that a lot of the states will use chronic absences to help identify schools in need of improvement under the new education law. So, you know, they've always tried to find ways to get kids to come to school, but even more so now, as far as it affecting their rating. And, you know, also it drives funding. So they can lose funding when kids don't show up.
Now, those numbers I read, those don't all imply that all of those kids are malevolently skipping school. There were years, I was a sickly kid, there were years I would have been counted under those statistics
exactly.
For missed schools due to illness. Do we know how much is, optional school missing?
No, there's no good data on that. Obviously, there are some kids who are out ill and they're going to miss. But in talking to some of the school officials out there, they do believe there's a good number of them just missing class, which is why they've went to these different measures of offering TVs and boxes of Cheetos or whatever kind of perks just to get them to come to class, to motivate them to come to school.
Yeah, we'll get into that rewards and punishment you wrote about. One of the innovative things was a school offering a laundry service. Can you talk about that story?
You know, that's something that hasn't been reported a lot, but that is a pretty big issue as of late. And actually, that school district is in New Jersey, Westside High School, New Jersey, and they had noticed that there was bullying going on in the school and that some kids, apparently, upon talking to them and their parents, did not want to come because their clothes were dirty. So basically what the school district did, they said, you know what, we got to provide some kind of laundry services for these kids so that they won't feel, you know, be bullied when they come to school in dirty clothes. So that's what they did. And come to find out, actually, Whirlpool Corporation, they have a program where they actually provide washers and dryers in some schools, and there's like 58 schools that they've actually set up laundromats in just to try to address bullying and to help with the chronic absenteeism rate, to keep it down.
And that opens a window onto maybe why some kids aren't showing up at the school. It might be conditions of homelessness or limited facilities at the home. It might be a stress also, or fears of coming to school.
No, that's a great point. And that's what's going on. You know, the days of, I know back in my day, you had the truant officer. They'd go around and round up the kids who were truant. Nowadays, you're seeing more of these school districts. They're actually just putting in, and they always have different names for them, but a lot of them are called truancy interventionists or truancy specialists, where they actually go into the home, and instead of just, you know, trying to round up the kid, they're looking at the situation. You know, is there electricity on? Does the family have food? Does the family need help? So they're looking at it from a social service type angle, too.
Talking to Tonnell Hobbs with the Wall Street Journal. She covers K-12 education, talking about efforts to keep kids in school and make sure they don't miss class for one reason or another. Donnell, you started to touch on the reward side of things. Some schools are trying incentives from very small to pretty big. Can you talk about the range of, carrots to try to get kids to come to school?
Yes, I mean, there is the range. There's obviously, you always have your certificates and everything. But more schools are starting to partner with the car dealerships, too, so that they can raffle off a car. You're seeing more TV giveaways. You know, if you have perfect attendance for the semester, you might get your name, in the bowl. And if they pick your name, you can walk off with a TV or a mini refrigerator. So they're trying different things to get the kids, and there's some superintendents that say it does work. Obviously, you have concern out there because people don't want these students to only come to school when they think they're going to get a perk or a gift, and then when the gifts stop, then what? So that's always a concern, too.
And then on the flip side, some schools, as you say, they're visiting homes, and some are trying to figure out targeted ways to punish kids if they don't show up, to give them that incentive to come to school. What are you seeing there?
Well, there's a school district that I carry. This might be more of the, as far as the situations go with the punishment, this might be one of the most major ones. But it's Dothan City Schools in Alabama, and what they're doing, if you have 10 unexcused absences, they're just, taking you out of school. They're disenrolling you. Your parent actually has to come back up and re-enroll you in school and pay a $25 fee. You don't see that happening a lot, and I don't know if that will catch on, but they felt like they needed to do something to get the parents' attention, so they will withdraw your child if they have 10 unexcused absences and the parents have to pay a fee to get them re-enrolled.
And it seems like a more common approach that you reported on was just better communication and making sure parents know if their kids aren't in school and some of the consequences.
Yes, definitely. And there was actually a study that came out, and, there's professors and there's researchers that will tell you there is no single solution to deal with this. But there was a couple professors that did a study, and they actually looked at just mail and personalized letters to the parents to let them know, hey, your child has been absent this many days. This is how it stacks up to other kids. And that seemed to be very helpful. So just something just as simple as, letting the parents know, because there are times when parents just really aren't aware that their child is missing so many days.
Now, it may seem obvious that if kids aren't in school, they're probably not learning at school. Our State Department of Public Instruction has an info sheet on the consequences of missing lots of school. Do we know long term how much it affects kids if they're missing more than, say, 10% of the school year?
Yeah, there's been research on that, and it's going to vary by school district and probably even state. But they do say that they've seen that when you look at the dropout rate, the kids that are at risk of dropping out are the ones with the chronic absenteeism problems.
We'll leave it there for now. Tonnell, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Tonnell Hobbs is the Wall Street Journal's national K-12 education reporter. We talked with her about her reporting on what schools are doing around the country to address a growing number of students missing class. When you think of the American Girl brand, probably the first thing that comes to mind is the dolls. But they also publish a magazine and books. And 20 years ago, the company published their book, The Care and Keeping of You. The book covers everything from the importance of self-esteem to how to shave for the first time, helping preteen girls feel comfortable about the changes happening in their bodies. If you grew up with a copy of this book, or maybe you're a parent who bought the book for your kid, how has it affected your life, your family? Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Joining us in the studio now is Valerie Lee Schaefer, author of The Care and Keeping of You. Valerie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Also in the studio, Barbara Stretchberry, currently executive editor at American Girl. She's been with the company for 20 years. Barbara, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, Barbara, I want to step back. Two decades now, this month. How did the company decide there was a need for a book like this?
So we were publishing a magazine, and there's an advice column in the magazine called Help, and we were getting thousands and thousands of letters from girls and on all kinds of topics. But what we were seeing a lot were topics about changing bodies and self-esteem and body image, and really wanting to understand how this change was going to affect them. So it really came from the girls. The idea came from them.
And Valerie, you're brought in to write this book. And this is a big topic, a tough topic. You're trying to please the kids, their parents, editors, the community at large. How do you start to tackle something like this?
I think what we did throughout the development of the editorial was fix in our mind a 10-year-old girl, who she was, what she was interested in, what she cared about, what she worried about. And I think holding that girl in our mind and in our heart was really our guiding star through the development of the book.
And Barbara, I understand that you had focus groups of girls in that age group that you worked with through this process.
Yes, and actually I wasn't there at the time, so I'm going to let Valerie talk about those groups.
Okay.
You know, the interesting thing about the focus groups is that they weren't scientific marketing focus groups. We gathered a loose collection of girls and mothers, mostly people who worked at American Girl, and it was really just to sort of get a handle on that girl and her interests and where she was so that we could meet her where she was. The impetus for the book wasn't really about satisfying anything learned from a formal marketing focus group. We had a sense that there was a need for this book. I don't think until we published it, we realized that there was a hunger for it.
And let's talk about the tone a little bit, Valerie, because I think there have been a lot of health curriculum books that have a very scientific and stodgy tone. What kind of voice did you want this book to be in?
Well, I think for us, what we wanted to adopt was a voice that really respected girls and really honored this time of transition in her life. And we said to ourselves as an editorial team, our voice is that of a favorite, beloved aunt. Somebody who's not your mother or father, but somebody who you trust. Somebody who you think is maybe just a little bit cooler than your mom. And that was the voice that we were really channeling for this girl.
And Barbara, can you talk about reaction to this book since it came out 20 years ago?
Sure. We still, to this day, get hundreds and hundreds of letters from girls still asking the same questions, still wondering, and they have just told us how much this book has meant to them, how meaningful it is, and the information that they learn, it just is very reassuring to them. And then also we hear from parents that it's so great to have this this book to help girls get through this time and help parents talk about this time with their girls.
And can you talk about how it's evolved over the years? I'm looking at a copy of a more recent edition. This is the body book for younger girls. There's different age groups. There's one for boys as well.
Right. So a few years ago, we were still looking at all this mail that we were getting from girls, and it became pretty clear to me that girls were not getting everything they needed from the first version of the book. And so I started thinking about what are those letters about? And a lot of it was the social, emotional changes that girls are going through. What happens after my period comes? Or what happens after I get my first bra? Like, what do I do next? And so we decided to take the material and kind of age it up a little bit and put it into a second edition. So there's a Care and Keeping of You 1 for girls who are 8 and older, and Care and Keeping of You 2 for girls who are about 10 and older, just so that they could get the right information at the right time. And then a few years ago, because we've been hearing from parents so often that they wish that there was a book like this for boys, because it's been so valuable for their daughters, we listened to them and we put out a similar book for boys. A lot of the information is the same, hygiene, sleep, exercise, mm-hmm. those kinds of things that every kid should know and grow up with.
We are talking about The Care and Keeping of You, the body book for girls. It was the original one. It came out 20 years ago this month. We have the author, Valerie Lee Schaefer, with us, and Barbara Stretchberry with American Girl, executive editor there now. And Valerie, can you talk about this? This is something that's basically a universal experience. Everybody's going to go through puberty at some point. And it's an incredibly unique experience that everybody goes through in some ways in their own brain.
Yeah, and I think especially for young girls in that 8 to 10 year range, it's a subject that's very sensitive and they feel very private about it. They may even feel embarrassed about it. And so a book is a way for a girl to get the information she feels ready to receive when she's ready to receive it. And our hope throughout has been that we've really engendered conversations between girls and their trusted adults, whether it's their mother, their father, or some other adult in their lives. And we hope that by giving them language and by giving them a little bit of courage, that they can have these conversations.
And more than that, I think it's maybe a topic that a girl might get a message, even if she wants to talk about it, from adults in her life, maybe peers. No, that's something you don't talk about.
Maybe, yeah. I think girls also are very social creatures for the most part. And our experience with this book is that this is something that girls like to read and talk about with their friends and in the privacy of their bedrooms. So sometimes they may not feel ready to talk to their mother about it. Mm-hmm. Or an adult, but they're ready to talk to their friends about it.
And Barbara, has the book evolved over time in terms of the images in it, the languages in it, the things it covers?
Sure. We did update the illustration about 7 or 8 years ago, just feeling like it was time to update the look and feel of the book. But a lot of the things have stayed the same because it's the information that was published 20 years ago was the right information for girls. And so it's still the same trim size. It's still the same tone. It still reaches girls where they are with these illustrations that are comforting and easy, and nothing is threatening in the book. So, yeah.
And Valerie, was there, I mean, this is talking about, as you say, sensitive topics for some people. Was there criticism, backlash in the early days after the book came out?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think by and large, the book was very well received. And I would say that criticism tends to fall in two completely polar opposite directions. The book goes too far. The book doesn't go far enough. Mm-hmm. And I think some people felt that some of the content was too explicit for their child. And some people felt like their child needed more information than what we provided. But I think we really hit the sweet spot in terms of what most girls and most families feels appropriate for that age range.
And Barbara, you say you've heard from a lot of girls who have read the book over the year. Is this something that you get the sense that the parents have been reading too, maybe before handing to the girl, or to be ready maybe for the questions that might arise?
Yeah, absolutely. We hear a lot from moms to tell other moms, go get that big white book from American Girl. Like, and so it's just this iconic thing that gets passed from mom to mom. And, I lost my train of thought.
I think also some of my favorite letters that I've received have been from fathers who have said, I'm a single dad or I'm a divorced dad and my daughter is becoming a more private person and I want her to feel like she can talk to me about whatever is on her mind. And this book has really helped me feel comfortable having a conversation with her.
I've heard from moms, too, who say they read it together and will look at it together and then tell their daughter, I'm going to put this book on your shelf and you can look at it when you need to. And girls will do that. They will go back to it over and over again. And then when they're ready, they know that their mom has given them this book. They're ready for this conversation and they can have this trusted conversation together.
You know, with the Body Book for Boys edition, I think I read that there's some skepticism. Are boys going to latch onto a book that's coming from American Girl?
Right. We didn't brand it American Girl for that reason. Because at the end of the day, we want boys to pick this up and learn the information inside. It's important to know how to take care of your body and know how to know what's coming as you're growing up.
And Valerie, for the older girls now, there was the separate book. What kind of mental health, I understand, was more of a focus in the sort of part two here. Can you talk about that?
I think that's right. I didn't write the second book in the series. That was written by a wonderful pediatrician named Karen Natterson. And it had a lot more information about menstruation. It had more information about mental health issues, body image issues, things that might be on the minds of a slightly older girl.
And Barbara, can you talk about, I mean, I was definitely in school in an era, and my kids are now, where a lot of the materials you see in school are clearly 20, 30 years old. Have you been trying to make sure that the look of the book doesn't look dated?
Right. I think that that's one of the strengths of American Girl, is that we really present the information, no matter if it's in the magazine or in a book, in this highly verbal, visual way, so that it's attractive to kids, it's not threatening, it's easy to read, and it's easy to understand. But at the same time, it's all information that they need to know for their growing bodies.
And Valerie, you say you hear from kids and parents. Now, 20 years, so that's a point where maybe people who read this as a kid are giving it to their own kids. Are you hearing multi-generational stories like that?
For sure. And when I wrote this book, I was pregnant with my first daughter. She's now 20, and it's really, really gratifying to hear from girls who are who've grown up with this book. It makes you feel really old.
Now, for your daughter, was reading the book like, oh, this is like talking to mom.
Yeah, I think my daughters had it on their bookshelves from the time they were babies, and they were like most girls. They read it in their bedrooms, and we didn't necessarily talk about it a lot.
And Barbara, you're counting on, I assume, publishing these for another 20 years and beyond?
Absolutely. We are so proud of this work. We are so proud of the girls that we've been able to reach and teach them healthy living skills and help them not be afraid of becoming a young woman.
And since this has come out, Valerie, have you gone and talked at, I don't know, schools or parenting groups about the book?
I sometimes do, especially in the community I live in. And what I really find is that many aspects of how we live have changed, but girls essentially at their core at 10 years of age are pretty much the same.
It's a good place to leave it. Valerie, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Barbara, thanks for coming up.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Valerie Lee Schaefer, author of The Care and Keeping of You, The Body Book for Girls. Barbara Stretchberry, also with us, executive director at American Girl. They talked to us about the 20th anniversary of the book, The Care and Keeping of You, and the different variations that have come out in the 20 years since. The Food and Drug Administration announced what it calls critical and historic action against retailers and e-cigarette manufacturers this week. The agency is worried about, quote, an epidemic of youth vaping. The agency is ordering 5 e-cigarette companies to submit plans detailing how they're going to prevent teens from using their products. If they fail, the FDA says it may take action, including removing flavored products from the market. In addition, it sent warning letters to more than 1,100 retailers who are selling e-cigarettes to minors. Those sales are illegal under federal law. FDA Commissioner Dr. Scott Gottlieb told CNBC this morning that the steps are necessary to help solve the problem.
We've long said that we see certain benefits potentially from the e-cigarette products for adult smokers who want to migrate off combustible products onto these products, which right. presumably don't have all the risks associated with them of combustion. But it cannot come at the expense of hooking a whole generation of kids onto nicotine and eventually onto tobacco products. So unfortunately, in order to close the on-ramp to kids, we're going to have to narrow that off-ramp for adults.
Douglas Jornby is a clinical psychologist and professor of medicine at UW-Madison. He's also a researcher with the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. Doug, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for inviting me.
So this move from the FDA, is this a big deal?
This is a huge deal. I mean, since Congress gave the FDA the deeming authority over tobacco products and then followed that up with the authority over what are sometimes called ENDS, electronic nicotine delivery systems, this is really the first time that the FDA has used any of that authority to draw a line in the sand, if you will.
Now, take e-cigarettes out of the picture for a moment. How are we doing when it came to teens and nicotine?
In terms of old school smoking, mm-hmm. we actually have been making progress in the last decade or so, seeing rates go down. But then e-cigarettes did appear. Really, I'm ashamed to say, as a public health person and a scientific researcher, out of the blue, it mostly caught us by surprise how quickly these caught on. And they have completely reversed that trend. We're seeing many more, especially middle and high school age people using e-cigarettes than traditional cigarettes.
Epidemic, the FDA says? Is that, I know public health maybe isn't a completely accurate word, but for the scope, the scale of the problem.
Yeah, if the trends continue the way that we've been seeing it, I think it's really helpful to look at population-wide. We're seeing a little over 3% of adults using e-cigarettes. If you look at middle schoolers, that's about 4%. And if you go up to high school, it jumps up to 11%. So we actually have more of young people using these devices than adults, which is allegedly, like Dr. Gottlieb was saying, the target market for them.
I've seen some people commenting on stories make an argument that goes along the lines of this. Okay, it's better for adults if they're smoking cigarettes to switch to e-cigarettes. Maybe these are kids who would be smoking old-fashioned, traditional, whatever we call them, you know, tobacco cigarettes. So maybe it's a net gain if those potential smokers are smoking e-cigarettes instead of tobacco. Is there anything to that?
Unfortunately, that's an if that kind of goes down in flames, and that's one of the things that we do have relatively reliable data on. When e-cigarettes first started becoming widely available in the States, they were almost all being sold to adults who were already regular cigarette smokers. So, yeah, some potential there for harm reduction, even though there's a lot of unknowns about that. Unfortunately, a couple of years ago, Adam Leventhal and some colleagues out in California, looking at their statewide prevalence data, found that among adolescents who had never smoked cigarettes at all, the ones who tried e-cigarettes were over four times more likely to start smoking regular cigarettes. And that's since been shown in other national data sets. So there's a clear trend that we've seen here that these actually are a gateway to using old school cigarettes with all of the negative health effects that come with those.
Talking to Doug Jornby from the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention, talking about this new action by the FDA, trying to crack down on the sale and marketing of e-cigarettes toward kids, teens. Now, let's talk about what the FDA is doing. What kind of actions are they taking here?
Well, I think there were two significant things that came out of the statement yesterday, and some of that was echoed in the introduction that you gave. One was they were talking about a series of stings, if you will, nationwide, where clearly there were convenience stores, there were other outlets that were selling to minors, which is something that's nothing new. The law has prohibited that for some time. So they made a clear statement that these underage sales are happening and need to be addressed. Where I think they stepped forward was Dr. Gottlieb was then basically drawing this line in the sand that within 60 days, and they identified five of the largest market share, but really it comes down to Juul, which has 70% of the e-cigarette market right now. And that came almost out of nowhere within the last couple of years, and says that they have to present, I think, substantial proof to the FDA that they have plans in place to keep their products out of the hands.
Talk about what these newer delivery vehicles look like. Some of them don't look like what we might think of as e-cigarettes and might be much easier to smuggle, bring into a school, use maybe even without somebody catching on.
Yeah, and I think there you've hit it for a lot of the concern, a lot of the call to action has come from educators. And those devices in particular are in some ways radically different from what's previously been available for e-cigarettes. They resemble kind of a large USB drive. So particularly if you're not up on, electronic cigarette technology or computer savvy, you may not realize when the kid walking down the hall is not carrying, their computer accessory. They also don't produce as much vapor. We were talking earlier about the fact that with the old school e-cigarettes, that's actually seen as a virtue. These are fairly discreet in terms of the amount of vapor that's exhaled when someone uses it. And the other thing that's not obvious, but I think is actually probably more important in the long run, is the Juuls, rather than e-liquid or e-juice, use pods with flavoring and a nicotine salt. And that delivers nicotine in a way that's much closer to what a traditional cigarette would do. So when we're thinking about people becoming dependent on nicotine, that's a big increase in the risk factor.
The FDA says, hey, if you big companies that have so much market share, Juul and the others, don't do something about this, we're going to look at limitations on what you could sell. I assume this doesn't mean completely banning e-cigs, but what kind of options would they consider?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I have no idea what the thought is at the FDA. They actually technically do have that ability, unlike with cigarettes, where the congressional legislation specifically prohibited them from banning cigarettes entirely. E-cigarettes, that could be on the board. I suspect what's more likely is the obvious target is going to be looking at the flavorings. So different kinds of e-juice, the pods that are used in the Juuls, a number of them come in flavors that are fruit, or in some ways they're, you know, candy, cereal. And we know those are really appealing to young people. That's kind of the starter set, if you will.
Is there an issue here that people think these companies are deliberately marketing to kids with products that seem stealthy enough to use in a school? There were, I think, ones that looked like juice boxes at some point, too, with kid-sounding flavors. It's not just, oh, an unfortunate side effect here.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right about some of the marketing, the things that really you have to look very carefully to realize that it's e-liquid and not a juice box. I personally, having worked with people who are quitting smoking for decades, find it really hard to imagine somebody that's, you know, used to smoking a pack a day of Camel Straights or Marlboros, you know, picking up a creme brulee flavor pod. It just doesn't seem to track very well.
Now, closer to home, we have the Neenah Common Council. They're scheduled to vote next week on a proposed ordinance that would ban all vaping by minors. Here's Assistant City Attorney Adam Vandenhuvel on Fox 11 News.
Bans any minor from possessing or using any vapor product, whether it has nicotine in it or not, anywhere in the city. So that can be in the school, that can be in a park, on the sidewalk. Anyone under the age of 18 will not be allowed to vape anywhere in the city.
And this added a new wrinkle to the story for me. I assumed vaping meant it had nicotine. It's already, minors aren't supposed to have nicotine-bearing electronic cigarettes. There's vaping without nicotine in it.
Technically, there is, although it's shocking when, adolescents are surveyed, close to 60% of them don't necessarily realize that there's nicotine in what they're vaping, even when it does contain that and it's labeled as such. But I think in terms of what they're proposing in Neenah, at the very least, it's practical, because there's no way to expect law enforcement or public health people to be able to walk by where someone's vaping on a device and be able to say, aha, you have nicotine in your e-juice. It's just realistically not going to happen.
We're talking about the push to limit vaping by teenagers. New announcements coming from the FDA. Doug Jornby is with us, clinical psychologist and professor of medicine at UW-Madison, and a researcher with the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. You can join in. What do you think? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Is the FDA right to threaten e-cigarette companies if they don't limit sales to minors? Are you worried about teens using e-cigarettes? Do you see it in your community, your school, your own family? How far should the FDA go to restrict availability of e-cigarettes if these companies can't prevent kids from using them? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. We're talking about the FDA's warning to e-cigarette makers and retailers to cut down on teen vaping or risk having some of their products maybe taken off of shelves. The city of Neenah is also considering an ordinance that would ban all vaping, nicotine or otherwise, by minors. Doug Jornby is with us, clinical psychologist, professor of medicine at UW-Madison. He's with the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. How concerned are you about teens using e-cigarettes? Do your kids vape? If you're a teenager yourself, a high school student, have you used e-cigarettes? Do you see your classmates doing it? And big picture, how would you like to see these products regulated? Should they be cracked down on? Some flavors taken off the market, some styles of delivery making maybe regulated more carefully? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Doug, we heard a definition question from Leah in Green Bay. Leah wonders, is there a difference between e-cigarettes and vaping? I tend to use them synonymously. Am I right?
Pretty much, yeah. Although some people actually do use the e-cigarette device in a different way. There's something called dripping, where people actually expose what the chamber is called, the cartomizer in it, and will drip e-liquid onto it, which actually delivers a more potent dose. And some of the technology is a little bit agnostic, so people put things that are not nicotine in the solution as well.
Now, another issue I've seen come up here is the idea that people who are of age, you know, not minors, buy lots and lots of stuff online from these manufacturers or distributors and then resell it. They're straw purchases who sell to minors.
Mm. Yeah, that's not something I have much experience with, but yeah. It certainly makes sense.
Is that something you'd hope to see regulated if that is happening?
Yeah, well, that would be a tricky thing to do.
And briefly, let's talk about a huge debate going on about the relative healthiness and unhealthiness of vaping as compared to cigarettes. What's the kind of state of science on that for maybe for that person who is smoking cigarettes?
Sure. Well, I think you have to start with the baseline. When you think about the cigarette, when that's used as directed, you know, ultimately it kills about half of people who are regular daily smokers. So it's hard not to do better than that. We know e-cigarettes don't deliver carbon monoxide. They don't deliver as many carcinogens. But this is something where research is kind of frantically trying to catch up with what's happening in the real world. So there are some concerns that have arisen that are specific to e-cigarettes, the effect of propylene glycol when it's inhaled in the lungs. But there's a lot that we don't know yet.
So they do less harm. That doesn't mean they're harmless.
Perfect way to encapsulate that, yeah.
Let's go to our callers now. Robbie is online in Greenfield. Robbie, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What do you think?
I think we're looking at the market and making decisions because they don't have, gosh.
All right, Robbie, I'll let you collect your thoughts there for a little bit, and then we'll go back to the phones in just a moment. But has there been a lot of criticism of these companies, Doug, for marketing flavors that might appeal to kids, as we were talking about earlier?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's certainly an easy target, especially for people that are concerned about the risks of young people, you know, taking this up, particularly as we were talking before, who might not otherwise have been exposed to cigarettes at all.
All right, we'll go now to Lyman in Edgerton. Lyman, hi.
Hi, I'm Lyman from Edgerton, home of the Tobacco Heritage Days. One of the thoughts that I had on this subject, and an excellent subject, Rob, thank you for the show, was that, you know, big tobacco or tobacco companies are notorious for their lobbying efforts. And I'm wondering, the FDA's comment about removing these vaping products from the market entirely seemed kind of aggressive. And I wonder if the quick growth in the vaping products market, maybe their lobbying efforts, I hate to sound too pessimistic, but maybe their lobbying efforts haven't caught up to the growth of the market. And what role is that that lobbying may be playing in this whole sort of drama as it unfolds?
Lyman, thanks for the call. So I guess a concern there that, okay, if we do dial back on e-cigarettes, does that ultimately help the big tobacco industry again?
Well, that's a complex question. And the tobacco industry has not survived and prospered as much as it has by, you know, being dumb. And in fact, at this point, all of the major international tobacco companies have acquired at least one e-cigarette company. So we were talking about how Juul has 70% of the market, but some of the others that were specified by Dr. Gottlieb, including Vuse and Mark 10, those are owned by big tobacco companies.
Lyman, thanks for that call. We're talking to Douglas Jornby from the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention, talking about teens and e-cigarettes, teens and vaping. The FDA says time for manufacturers and retailers to figure out a way to make sure teens aren't using their products. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Go back to our callers now. David is on the line in Beloit. David, hi.
Hi. Great topic. My comments are on nicotine itself. We use it in the farm as on chicken roost to kill the lice on their feet. And as far as I know, it's the only legitimate use for nicotine. Otherwise, it's toxic. It's a poison. We've been ingesting it in cigarettes for a long time. Now it shows up in vape. For whatever reason, I don't know, but it's a deadly product. It shouldn't be ingested in any way. And then it appeals to youngsters, like you said, when they flavor it to entice them. And my thoughts are it's just dumb.
David, thanks for the call. Yeah, you think of nicotine as the addictive part and the stuff that comes along with it. The other things in the tobacco are the dangerous part. Is there something inherently, apart from the addictive side of it, inherently unhealthy about nicotine itself, Doug?
Yeah, nicotine itself, as David said, it's not just mites that it kills. It, at a sufficient dose, it's quite lethal to people, too. Using vaping or cigarettes, most people are able to titrate the dose, so that doesn't happen. But unfortunately, with increased sales of e-liquid, there have been cases every year of particularly, you know, very, very young children that drink or spill the liquid on themselves because the nicotine is absorbed through the skin. And that can, unfortunately, be fatal.
Thanks a lot for that call, David. Do we have any sense, I don't know if there's numbers like this, on how we're doing in Wisconsin in particular, more or fewer kids using e-cigarettes?
Yeah, we don't have great statewide data, but we're pretty close to the national norms with that.
All right. Thanks again for that call. What happens next? The FDA has given this timeline to companies. As you said earlier, you don't know what exactly the FDA is thinking here, but what are you watching for as the companies try theoretically to tackle this problem?
Well, I'm sure the next 2 months are going to be extraordinarily busy for them as they scramble to come up with a plan. And I honestly don't know what that would look like, whether they would voluntarily, say, pull away some of the flavors that, you know, are easy targets for regulation, whether they're going to push back hard against this. Certainly, Juul has been stressing that they don't target adolescents, and they're actually helping adults use less of their product.
So what are you watching for now as we go forward with e-cigarette use among teens and when we hit a tipping point where maybe the numbers start to come back down?
Well, probably at some point they will. The real question, I think, from a public health point of view is how many of those people then convert to cigarette smokers? Because that's certainly what we've seen with adults, where the appeal of using e-cigarettes to get off traditional cigarettes is there. But unfortunately, we know the vast majority of those people don't. They become dual users. So they vape sometimes, they smoke sometimes.
So if we're going to keep these away from teens, do we need to start thinking about treating nicotine addiction for teens to make sure when the e-cigarettes go away, they don't just start finding regular cigarettes?
And I think that'll definitely be necessary for at least some people.
We'll leave it there for now. Doug, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
I've been talking to Doug Jornby, clinical psychologist and professor of medicine at UW-Madison. He's also a researcher with the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. Been talking about the FDA's call for e-cigarette makers and retailers to curb vaping use by teens and a threat by the FDA that they might regulate those products more strictly if the companies don't come up with a plan. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, don't drain the swamp. Not the real-life swamps, anyway. Our guest makes the case that wetlands are important for things like flood prevention, biodiversity, and reducing the impact of climate change. We'll meet a Wisconsin farmer who's opening up conversations about mental health and suicide in rural Wisconsin. He has a lot of stories to share. And on Food Friday, Got Leftovers, we'll check out a cookbook that helps us use them up in non-boring ways. That look at some of the top news stories of the day. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.